Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching us later, these are some of the stories that really matter. And coming up on the program, what a wealth tax would mean for South Africa. A huge rise in students attending TVET colleges. Is it time to get rid of the idea that this is second-tier education? A big push to use drones for border security, and conservation is facing an uncertain future amid US funding cuts. It's Wednesday, March the 5th. Now, the topic of a wealth tax in South Africa is one that is not going away. With the Treasury forced to rethink its revenue plans after the postponed national budget, reports are now suggesting that a wealth tax is potentially back on the table as a way to fill that fiscal gap. Critics argue that such a move could trigger further emigration of high net worth individuals. It could possibly shrink the tax base and discourage investment. Yet government officials see this as a way, reportedly, to ease the tax burden on the working and middle class, while also increasing state revenue. So let's put all of this together. What could this mean, a wealth tax for South Africans, particularly those with substantial assets, both at home and abroad? I'm in conversation now with John Paul Fraser, team lead cross-border taxation at Tax Consulting SA. John Paul, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with the basics. Could you explain to me exactly what a wealth tax is and how it differs from other taxes like income tax or even capital gains?
Firstly, thank you very much, Jeremy, for having me on. Absolute pleasure to be here. And yes, I think that's an incredibly great place to start. So I think primarily the difference is where, firstly, your income tax is levied across the board per specific rules. So generally, anyone who's earning taxable income will be paying income tax. Whereas a net or a wealth tax is essentially indicating certain individuals who are above a certain net worth, and your actual net worth is then taxed. Another distinction is, in terms of an income tax, you're being taxed on actual liquid money that you're bringing in, whereas a wealth tax is situated or premised on your net wealth. So the problem arises then essentially where you're not actually earning an income from being paid and being taxed on it. Your net wealth doesn't mean you have liquid cash to pay a tax as well. So that's where it's also a bit different in terms of an income tax, which is based on liquid income that you're bringing in, versus your actual net wealth based on assets that maybe aren't generating you any income in at this specific time.
And John Paul, given that there's so many ways of hiding this or at least obscuring it, how does one work out what a person's net worth is?
That's an incredibly tough task, Jeremy, to be honest. I mean, SARS has increased their, for example, cooperation with financial institutions. So you'll see a lot of reporting from banks, and also just anyone in your intermediary services, financial intermediary services, are now having to report on their statistics to SARS. That's one way. But aside from that, SARS generally operates on the premise, such as another good example is of crypto assets. How does SARS actually have any insight of what you own in crypto? So they do place an onus on the taxpayer to actually declare this type of income and net wealth. And then you run the risk of, if you don't declare it, there's obviously adverse penalties, possible criminal prosecution, etc. So it is an incredibly tough task, but those are essentially the measures that SARS has to try and track what your net wealth would be.
Do we have any indication at this point, and I understand that it's all conceptual, John Paul, but of what sort of rate a wealth tax would be calculated at?
It is conceptual at this stage. I do not have any insight as to what your actual wealth tax would be calculated at. I do know, as of 2018, the Davis Committee essentially said, look, we need to play, well, there's a lot of considerations that need to be taken into account. So it's not an off-the-cuff decision, but I can't answer with an actual percentage of net or your wealth tax at stake.
Fair enough. Let's look at the practicality of a wealth tax, though. It would be an effective way to generate revenue, or do you think that the risks outweigh the benefits?
So look, it's definitely an effective way to generate revenue. What the consequences, but again, like you said, the consequences could be quite grave. Already South Africa, I mean, everyone is aware there is an exodus of specifically, let's say, your higher net wealth individuals, such as millionaires. In an article recently published in 2024, it was projected that 600 millionaires would leave the borders of South Africa. So we are currently in the top 10 countries losing millionaires. So again, to incentivize taxpayers, you are in that kind of tax bracket or net wealth brackets, to leave South Africa is definitely going to have an effect. We are seeing just practically on the ground in the consultations we are having with individuals like this, that there's not much more needed for someone to completely say they are actually done with the country and they want to formalize their financial immigration process and rather invest elsewhere or relocate and reside elsewhere, you know. So it's a tough call, and I do think it would have incredibly adverse consequences.
Is there international experience that tells us anything about the effectiveness of wealth tax? There is a sense as well that while it's seen as an easy revenue generating opportunity for the fiscus, it might not yield the expected revenue, as you've mentioned, due to either tax avoidance or capital flight.
100%. In terms of a wealth tax, I mean, there's plenty of countries talking of implementing such a tax. Your top 1%, for example, they'll call it maybe in the US. But definitely, it's just again incentivizes the hiding of offshore assets. That the scenario does where individuals who are in a high net worth kind of brackets have assets situated not just within a single country or jurisdiction, multiple countries and jurisdictions, which again there would be a prevention of double taxation. So those assets then could be subject to actually not being taxed in the country that's looking to tax the net wealth. So it is definitely, again, incentivizing hiding of certain assets or avoiding the declaration of those assets, which already is a problem that we are seeing, Jeremy, especially where offshore assets are in play, you know.
How difficult is it to simply cease South African tax residency?
So look, I mean, there's a distinction prior to 2021 versus after 2021. Prior to 2021, the process encompassed dealing with the Reserve Bank and exchange control. At present, we're running a system SARS is running a system that deals exclusively with your tax status. So it has become a lot more efficient, if I can say that. So if you have, for example, an intention not to return to South Africa, you have physically left the borders of South Africa, and there's enough what we call objective factors indicating that South Africa is no longer your ordinarily resident or place of residence or permanent home, as we would call it, then you're eligible to cease tax residency under our local domestic tax law. Everyone colloquially refers to it as your financial immigration. That is not as complex as another mechanism, which is referred to as a double tax agreement in ceasing tax residency. But I think for the purpose of this, we are talking about individuals who are permanently leaving South Africa. And it's not as, how do we say it, as onerous as it might come across to be in terms of following the process. So it's definitely advisable, if it is applicable to an individual, that they at least follow the formal process.
All right. Just in conclusion, then, let me widen the lens on the conversation. For listeners who are now concerned about their financial future, are there immediate steps that they should be taking now to prepare for any potential tax changes, in other words, the wealth tax, in coming months?
Definitely. I'll make two distinctions. The first one is already those who are abroad to formalize your non-tax residency in South Africa. The objective or the outcome of this process is that SARS operates on a residence-based system. So for as long as you don't formalize your immigration with SARS, they will continue to have the right to lay claim and tax your worldwide income and assets. So those already outside of the borders of South Africa, really an urge and unction to formalize that with SARS before SARS gets a little more desperate and starts to look outside the borders of South Africa, which they currently are doing, to increase their tax collection. Those who are in South Africa and concerned, to definitely start the process of at least inquiring as to, firstly, when would they like to depart? If it is an imminent thing, then definitely to get into discussions with the tax consultant advise him on how to formally seize their tax residency. It can be implemented as soon as you have left the borders of South Africa and arrived in your new home country. So it's not something to be put off. So it's definitely worthwhile considering at this stage if there are any concerns, whether you're outside of South Africa or still in South Africa.
Well, obviously, we're going to get a lot more clarity on Wednesday the 12th. I'm going to thank you, John Paul Fraser, Team Lead Cross-Border Taxation at Tax Consulting South Africa. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's youth unemployment crisis demands, many say, a radical shift in how we view education and skills training. Despite a 46% rise in enrollment at so-called TVET colleges, many still perceive these institutions as inferior to universities. And I'm wondering if this mindset could be worsening as the country's skill shortage in key trades and technical fields intensifies, or whether the mindset is in fact improving. I want to talk to Spiwe Masuku, who's head of brand and marketing at the agency Fundi, who's done some work in this respect and is going to make, I think, the case for rethinking vocational education. Spiwe, very warm welcome. So why, first of all, do you think TVET colleges are still viewed by many as a second-tier education option?
Society stigmas, basically. So when we are growing up, we are taught that if you want to be successful in your career or in your education, university is where you go first. And now of recently, when we are doing the research and actually wanting to understand the skill gaps in South Africa and the people that we are hiring or that are occupying certain jobs, we realize that it's mostly university students with theoretical work, but also understanding the shift that we are now in an era where unemployment is so high and your TVET colleges are skilling you with practicals. They're exposing you with real work experience. And with those, you don't need to go find employment. You can actually be an entrepreneur and hire people, you know, and be your own boss. So this is what triggered, you know, the insight and the investigation, wanting to understand the student behavior and why they deem TVET colleges to be inferior than universities.
One argument, of course, is that TVET colleges themselves are to blame. There is a sense maybe that the quality of the education that they are providing isn't always good, or at least is a little bit perhaps not static, but perhaps a little bit bumpy at times.
Yes. So I think we can argue this one, right? So similar to when you have something that you're doing with passion, right? You always find ways to ensure that you succeed. So you, as an individual, you go to a point of taking what has been exposed to you in this training facilities, and you actually have to amplify on it and, you know, grow it bigger. If you, for an example, you are an electrician, you can't wait for every session to happen the way it should be, but you need to expose yourself and have somewhat interest to see how the real life experience in your household, you know, with little things before, you know, people do big things and houses explode. But you have to want to do something and to extend it. And, you know, not everything should be blamed on what we receive. I think the other thing is, what you do as a person also goes a long way.
So we are seeing a growing enrollment in TVET colleges. Do you think that might slowly be a reflection of changing attitudes?
So two things, right? Students are going to your traditional universities first, and they are deeming or they are jotting down the TVET colleges as their second option. And I'd say, you know, this is a very positive growth that we are seeing, because the economy is actually struggling. There is shortage of skills. And, you know, I applaud these students to have put these colleges as their second option and not just take another gap year and not do anything at all, you know, about their careers. So this means that we are now having the mindset of the youth thinking, you know, I need to do something. So it's positive. And it means that we as institution like Fundi, where we offer tools for students to understand Their career choices, their career options according to their personality types through our Fundimage processes. It means that we need to also, you know, expose students to these tools so that they can take them and understand what can they do outside of, you know, the university if they have been rejected or they didn't find space in those areas. So a Fundimage is a psychometric assessment test that one can take to look at their personality type and what career path they can potentially look at. So those are some of the things that we are looking at. So public awareness with the institution is also important. Industry collaborations. We need to collaborate with the industries where the skills shortages. We need to make noise about it. We need to let our youth know that being a plumber shouldn't be looked down on. It's not only your doctors, your nurses that are actually, right, you know, important, available in the community.
Let me ask you this question. We've looked at it from a student perspective, but what about employers in this country? Are they starting to embrace TVET graduates with a little more enthusiasm, or do you think that there is still a bias?
Look, it depends what sector it is. And obviously, we know certification is one thing that all of us were taught, that for you to land a professional job, you need to be certified. But also, I think what is happening with employers now, they are gradually exposing themselves out there and wanting, you know, our youth and consumers to understand the needs and how to go about attaining those skills. So I'd say they are gradually moving into embracing students from TVET colleges, because again, it's not about the paper that you put on the table when you are being interviewed, but also when you're going through a journey of understanding how skilled you are and what you can offer for them. I think it's coming from that. So the bias is basically shifting a little bit, where I can comfortably say that it's a positive one with the employers too.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Spiwe Masuku, Head of Brand and Marketing at Fundi. Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at Midday. Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
South Africa is embracing advanced technology to bolster security at our borders, with drones now playing a vital role in this transformation. At the forefront is Milcor, a Pretoria-based company set to launch the Milcor 380. I'm told it's the largest drone ever made on the continent. It boasts capabilities to aid national defense and tackle pressing issues like crime and poaching. As government and the private sector recognize the potential of drone technology, my question is the country now shifting towards a more effective approach to security management? From the organization Milcor, it's an aerospace company. Daniel Duplessis, Communications Director, thank you very much indeed. Let's wade in with that then. Why are drones becoming increasingly important in surveillance?
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy. I appreciate it. I think you summed that up correctly. There's a large shift towards unmanned technologies in general. Not just in military environments, but also for regional and domestic peacekeeping operations. So what we've seen is that there's an influx in the safety and operational efficiency that unmanning a system can offer. Essentially, if you take it in a direct comparison, if you have to do surveillance operations from the air, you typically have an aircraft outfitted with a lot of sensors, with a pilot that can fly for a total estimate of between 6 to 8 hours at most. Where with an unmanned aerial vehicle, you can have the aircraft in the air, such as the Milcor 380, for more than 30 hours, with a maximum of 35 hours in a surveillance configuration. So it therefore gives you a larger type of operation with longer endurance surveillance operations to gather more intel and more information to make the decisions effectively.
And a lot more cost-effective, one imagines.
That's exactly that as well. So instead of then having to pay the salaries and onboarding fees and the fuel costs, you said you'd have a lot of weight savings in the operational efficiency and cost efficiency of an unmanned aerial system in the long run is always more beneficial. So that's something we've identified in the military environment. But if we focus solely on the South African issues currently faced, alongside the borders, alongside the domestic issues we have some issues with poaching activities in the Kruger National Park. All of these issues can be addressed with a system like the Milcor 380, and it's something we're pushing quite hard and hoping that we can find a solution with the government as well.
Let me ask you specifically about the country's border security. How would this drone be deployed, and how would it improve capability?
So essentially, the issues around the border and all of the activities that happen alongside it is now the responsibility of the Border Management Authority, or the BMA. And they have a very significant task ahead of them. They have to cover more than 4,000 kilometers of land border, and at the same time also patrol the ocean border of more than 2,500 kilometers as well. So it's a huge task, and equipment on the ground or on the sea itself will not cover it. It'll be a tremendous investment to get enough equipment. So deploying a system like the Mokul 380, which can fly for 4,000 kilometers in one single operation, allows you to have 24/7 surveillance capabilities. Now, if you strategically deploy some of these systems alongside your coastal borders and land borders, you essentially can switch them in a tandem, where you have a continuous surveillance capability that uses very highly sophisticated sensors, radar apertures, and camera systems to identify patterns and recognize illegal crossings and illegal activities.
The challenge, of course, is always to ensure that these drones are used both responsibly and ethically.
It is a huge challenge, and it's something our company prioritizes quite well. It's not just about using it ethically. It's also making sure that the people on the ground that are operating this UAV are trained sufficiently to make the most out of the system that we provide. So it's for that reason that we've invested quite a lot of efforts into setting up facilities that can essentially train personnel, even if they have no prior knowledge to drone operations or any aeronautical operations, taking them from a very basic level of flight theory all the way to a fully qualified drone pilot within our company's internal training structures as well, which can last anywhere from 6 months to 1 year to efficiently train these operators. So it doesn't entail just the operation and the piloting of the drone, but also extracting the information and maintaining the system as a whole.
And to that extent, has the South African Air Force been involved?
Yeah, so we've approached multiple entities within the DoD and the SANDF. There are some doctrines which allow certain branches of the SANDF to operate strategic and operational UAVs. So we've approached all of them, including the SAF, and we've also signed in a memorandum of understanding to continue testing this UAV with their help. And we've had tremendous support from their side as well. So yes, the discussions are ongoing. I think it is imminent that at some point the SANDF will be the primary user for this. But the invitation also stands to all security and defense clusters within South Africa, including the SAPS, SAMSA, and Transnet, as well as the newly established BMA, to open discussions and have a dialogue about the efficiency and the opportunities that these type of systems can offer.
How much do these things cost?
Yeah, it's a very common question that I find. Typically, we try to keep it under wraps, but purely because it's a strategic asset, right? There are only about 7 or 8 countries in the world that have the capability to manufacture drones of this size. Therefore, we engage with the end users directly, and we try to keep it hidden from the rest of the market because it's a very competitive market out there.
When can we expect to see these drones fully deployed, do you think? Do you have a timeline?
So we've actually established a baseline now with the first few units sold and exported to some countries abroad. So therefore, we are moving away from a development cycle to an industrialization cycle and a manufacturing cycle. So these drones are essentially ready for deployment as we speak right now. Currently, we've built up to 8 units, with a few units to be imminent before the Q2 this year. So the order books are open, and we're ready to take orders and to start deploying these drones. So within the next 12 months, I think we could see some of these systems available in South Africa.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Daniel Duplessis, Communications Director at the aerospace company Mokul.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now, wildlife conservation has always relied heavily on international funding, with organizations like the Endangered Wildlife Trust depending on grants from global agencies. But with the United States now freezing foreign funding through institutions like USAID and the US Fish and Wildlife Service, conservation efforts in Africa are potentially facing an uncertain future. While much has been said about the impact on healthcare, the conservation sector has been left scrambling for alternative funding sources. So how do we ensure that species protection, anti-poaching operations, and habitat restoration efforts continue? And are there innovative financing mechanisms that can help bridge the funding gap? I'm joined now by Kish Chetty, Executive Head of Sustainability at EWT, the Endangered Wildlife Trust. Kish, so the US funding freeze, and thank you very much for joining us, has hit conservation efforts hard. What has been the immediate fallout for organizations like yours?
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for having me on your show, and good day to you and your listeners. So, Jeremy, I think the immediate fallout has been, without this funding, there's been certain critical conservation initiatives which are at risk. They include species protection, habitat restoration, community safeguarding, and some of our work around policy. So it has led to job losses. Certain critical research in the conservation sector has slowed. We've had disruption to some of the key conservation action plans, not just within South Africa, but across the borders. And it, as you indicated, has weakened our anti-poaching efforts and increased human-wildlife conflict. So it has been quite tremendous. And I think one of the things to better understand it is that a lot of the conservation funding that comes into South Africa is funded by international entities. So whether it's the United States, the European Union, private foundations or multilateral institutions, we do get a lot of funding, and it does provide the impetus for us to actually drive conservation in South Africa.
So are there immediately conservation programs or even species that face the greatest risk if you don't find alternative funding?
So from a species perspective, I know that some of the funding that we had lined up was dedicated towards vulture conservation and also our canine scent detection unit, which actively deals in anti-poaching efforts. And I think anything involved in the anti-poaching space and wildlife trade is certainly at risk. And certainly from a threatened species perspective, conservation efforts and action around vultures could face significant risk in the days ahead.
Kish, as upsetting as this is, it also says a lot about the fragility of conservation funding models that rely so heavily on international donors.
Absolutely. And I think where this has been upsetting, it's also created an opportunity. So the opportunity lies in mobilizing local investment and potentially starting to build a better business case for biodiversity and conservation with the private sector, which will hopefully lead towards building stronger regional partnerships and potentially exploring the opportunities around sustainable finance solutions.
So how do you make a case for local investment given there are so many competing priorities?
It's a very good question. I think the key is, as a conservationist and as the conservation sector, we need to start showing return on investment. I think that's a critical component in being able to bring the private sector into the conversation. And if we can do that, then we've got a better chance in diversifying our funds towards achieving the conservation action we need on the ground.
So within the space of conservation, what does return on investment mean, and how would you go about demonstrating it?
So I think with regards to return on investment, we actually need to better understand the business case. So as an example, within Africa, a lot of our conservation is, or a lot of our ecotourism is dependent on conservation. And I think we need to build a better business case around what are some of the values that conservation does allow for in the context of business. So is there an opportunity to bring in funding? Does it improve corporate image? Does it have an influence around communities? Does it allow for sustainable business practices into the future? Does it align to compliance? And I think these are some of the pillars that we need to start looking at to drive conservation and produce this measurable, tangible outcome in relation to return on investment.
And have organizations like EWT started that process already? And if so, what sort of response are you getting?
So, absolutely. I think the response has been really positive. We've been working with a lot of the large listed companies in South Africa around, one, capacitating them to better understand the opportunities around biodiversity and business, but two, to better understand the return on investment so that they, as an organization, can start to put forward what the value add is of biodiversity to their business. And we've definitely seen a lot of traction, but there's loads more work to do in this space. And certainly if we want to bring the private sector into the conversation around conservation, we have to start driving this return on investment process.
And in many ways, you're also dealing with optics here, because I'd suggest to you that for any big organization to be involved in wildlife is a nice to have, but not necessarily seen as critical.
So I think Optics is absolutely key. And I think, as you suggested, you know, most businesses see it that way. And most people who sit on an executive or on a board level might see it that way. And it's up to us as organizations to start to build the right type of language around conservation and why conservation is absolutely critical towards businesses and their value chains to ensure long-term sustainability. And I think that's something that, as a conservation entity, we need to start doing a lot better in that space.
You've also spoken about your future fit strategy, and you're looking at things like biodiversity credits, wildlife bonds, and even carbon markets that are explored as alternative funding models. How viable are these solutions in Africa, though?
So viability is quite a broad word. I think it is viable, Jeremy. And what we need to do now is, as a collective across the African continent, start to pilot a number of projects where we can actually showcase proper return on investment. And I'm not just talking about return on investment from a finance sense. I also want to see tangible conservation outcomes on the ground. So there are opportunities to implement that and integrate it in the African context, but we need more case studies, we need more pilot projects, and we need to start bringing in key investors into driving these particular outcomes to ensure long-term sustainability of conservation.
And Kish, early days here just in terms of funding, but is there general unanimity within the wildlife community to work together as far as this is concerned? Previously, I would suggest, and correct me if I'm wrong, all of you are competing with each other to an extent to get a very small slice of that funding pie.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, historically, NGOs have, in some respects, been quite competitive, and there is a small piece of the pie available. But in order for us to achieve global and national outcomes, collaboration is absolutely key. And collaboration will also enable us to start to scale up our efforts. So I think there's been a lot of discussions in South Africa, certainly, and across the African continent about NGOs starting to collaborate and work towards the greater goals. And that means bringing in resources, not just funding, but bringing in resources and skill sets to achieve these greater goals at scale. And I'm certainly seeing that work out at the moment.
Well, that is good news. I'm going to leave it there. Kish Chetty, thank you very much indeed. Executive Head of Sustainability at the Endangered Wildlife Trust. I do appreciate your time. And that's MoneyWeb at Midday for today. Join us again tomorrow for more insights shaping the country and the future. We're live at noon weekdays, then up as a podcast. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.